you can understand history as a narrative of love, of God's expression of love to humanity, and then of humanity's response. And sometimes that response has been horrible, where the founders of all the religions have in their own way suffered horrible persecutions, their followers have suffered horrible persecutions. But that darkness, in a way, casts the light in greater relief. And then when you see the humblest people, utterly ordinary people, doing extraordinary things out of this transformative love that they've experienced.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn. Today on In Good Faith, I'm speaking with Michael Sabat. He's a member of the Baha'i community in Calgary, Canada, and that's where he's speaking to me from. Michael, thank you for making time today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Michael works as editor of the Journal of Baha'i Studies and is a PhD candidate in political science at the University of Toronto. His research involves putting a Baha'i framework for governance into dialogue with political philosophy. He's a lawyer by training, having practiced constitutional litigation in Ottawa after clerking at the Supreme Court of Canada. So a couple of questions just right off the bat. I'm going to get more into what the Journal of Baha'i Studies is. That's very exciting to me. What took you to law? And then how does that apply? Because there is a real focus in the Baha'i faith on people working together. Is that part of how you're combining your law knowledge?
Well, that's something I haven't explicitly thought about, is sort of what was the connection between what I studied and then my sort of spiritual journey. So I guess a few things that come to mind. I mean, you know, on the one hand, there's a strong understanding, I think, in the Baha'i faith that what we're about as human beings is not just our own individual journey, which I think Baha'is, like all religious people, would understand as primarily a spiritual journey. But that's not all we do. We also collectively are here on Earth for a short amount of time in order to build something together and really to advance civilization. And so from that perspective, I think the establishment of the rule of law, which is something that maybe in our part of the world we can sometimes take for granted, it really, like when you step back, it's a astounding historical development that we live in a time when people with power can't arbitrarily decide what happens to people without power, at least in principle and hopefully often in practice. They're constrained by law, which makes it's a kind of sort of equality before the law. I think, you know, as someone who left the law, partly just because it personality wise maybe wasn't a great fit, it's something that I need to not take for granted, that, you know, this is a huge step forward civilizationally for human beings that really in the big picture of history is kind of new. And then as you said, I think, you know, in the Baha'i faith there's an enormous emphasis on building unity and building a unity that doesn't ignore our differences, but that finds a way to recognize them as sources of sort of richness and beauty amongst human beings and not necessarily a source of conflict. And so in that context, you know, there are developments within the law that seem to be tending in that direction as well. So an increasing emphasis on mediation and arbitration instead of having recourse to the courts where possible. As I think about what I learned about the law in school, and then I contrast it to the understanding of law that I have arrived at, and that sort of is continuing to evolve in the context of the Baha'i faith, it's just very different, the different ways we can think about law in wider society. And I think probably we have a similar picture in religion, broadly speaking. We can sometimes think of law as sort of the limit on our ability to go have fun. Like, you know,
the expense of other people.
Exactly. You can do what you want until the point where the law decides you're causing some harm, so we're gonna make that illegal and there'll be consequences. And I think particularly in the religious context, we can easily associate the idea of religious law with ideas about punishment, sort of in this world or the next. And I think there's a spirit common to all the great religious traditions that's maybe just made explicit in the Baha'i faith, that if we accept and if we believe that law is something that God has given us, then we can actually understand it in quite a different way. So maybe the place I go to for that is there are a few statements in a book that was written by Baha'u'llah, who was the founder of the Baha'i faith. and it's his book of laws. And really, before getting into any specific laws that he's asking his followers to adhere to, he just talks about law at the level of principle. And he says things like, observe my commandments for the love of my beauty, which is very interesting. In the courts, we don't appeal to people to honor their contracts for love of each other or for love of some higher principle necessarily. But Baha'u'llah says this is the most profound motivation to obey a law, is out of love for God. And then he goes further and he says, and I'll just read this because I find it quite beautiful. He says, O ye peoples of the world, know assuredly that my commandments are the lamps of my loving providence among my servants and the keys of my mercy for my creatures. And then he also says, think not that we have revealed unto you a mere code of laws. Nay, rather, we have unsealed the choice wine with the fingers of might and power. So there's some idea here that from a religious perspective, if we accept these laws, then they free us. And they're a gift. And that's I think, reflected in what some of these laws are. So obviously, as in any system of laws, you have to have laws against behavior that clearly harms other people. So murder is unsurprisingly frowned upon in the Baha'i faith. So there's just a clear law. Don't do
this.
So
glad to hear that.
Yeah. And for those ones, you can have clear penalties. But then there's so many laws that aren't even conceivably enforceable by any external authority. So it's a commandment not to lie. And it's a commandment not to backbite, which is sort of to say something negative about someone who isn't present. And those are not even, there's no conceivable way in which those could be enforced, and there's no penalty prescribed. And yet somehow that's considered to be law, but it has to be a law that we take ownership for ourselves. And I mean, it can be extraordinarily challenging, but the motivation to keep striving to live up to that standard, I think, comes from this understanding of law, of ultimately it's rooted in love, that because God loves us, he sends us guidance that can help us develop. And then because we return that love, we do our best to obey the guidance.
You know, some faiths I grew up around and hearing little bits about, or they showed up on TV and I saw stereotypes, true or not true, but I had some formation in my mind of what they were. I came to knowing about the Baha'i faith later. I've been lucky enough in Israel to go to the headquarters and to the shrine and up to Akka. And recently, last year in Chicago, I went to the beautiful temple that's up there a little bit north of the city. I would love to know how you came to the Baha'i faith and just sort of that part of your faith journey.
I know the Baha'i faith is still probably one of the religions that maybe your listeners know less about than some of them once, with more numerous adherents in North America. So basically, to be a Baha'i just means you're someone who believes that the message that Baha'u'llah brought is the message intended to guide humanity for today, and that Baha'u'llah was a messenger from God, what Baha'is would call a manifestation of God, which is the understanding Baha'is have of sort of the great teachers of history, from Baha'u'llah himself to Christ, Muhammad, the Buddha, some of whom, of course, whose names have been lost to history. So with that understanding, I suppose the question then is sort of, how did I come to believe that this claim that Baha'u'llah makes to carry this message from God, did I come to believe that was true? So I was raised in a Baha'i family, and it's one of the, well, laws, I guess, in the Baha'i faith, that once you are 15, then you're considered to be of an age where you can make decisions about your own spiritual affiliation.
Right.
I guess I had always sort of, once I was old enough to understand it, I always believed Baha'u'llah's claim. And I think that was for a few reasons. One was, and maybe most basically, just the power of the Baha'i writings. And I think this is something that many religious people will say, that there's something that can happen when you read scripture that it's very hard to put into words. And that difficulty, I think, can create challenges for people who are not religiously minded, as sort of a, there doesn't seem to be anything there sort of challenge. Mm. But it's just one of these ineffable experiences that some people have experiencing the beauty of nature or the beauty of a piece of art. It's a combination of an appeal, I think, to the rational mind and also to our aesthetic sense. That's something just, this resonates with truth in a way that would be hard to pin down. So that was part of it.
I like how you just phrased that, because as you were talking, I thought, how do I describe when I read sacred writings that speak to me? And it's almost this sort of sense that I'm in the presence of truth. I don't know how else to describe that.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that, in the presence of truth. There's almost a relationship established. And yeah, it makes it very hard to pin down. Baha'is are big fans of science, and I think the increase in capacity in just the past couple hundreds of years for science to more and more accurately describe certain aspects of reality using a certain methodology that essentially breaks things apart and looks at the parts and analyzes them very carefully and systematically to reach conclusions. That's been an unbelievable bounty for our species.
But I think I interrupted you because you said the writings were speaking to your head, and I think maybe you were about to go to the heart. That's my guess.
So I would actually say that connection feeling was the heart connection. Mm. And it was complemented by a connection with the head, where I found the principles that Baha'u'llah reveals to be cogent, to make sense for the stage that humanity's at, and also just sort of the vision of what the nature of religion is and what its historical trajectory has been, I found really, really resonated at an intellectual level. So all that to say that basically, yeah, when I turned 15, I felt that, yes, this is something I do believe in. In the most meaningful way, I'd say I was a Baha'i all along.
Is there, some folks would say there's a christening or a baptism, or some would say you take a vow. Is there a ritual associated?
That's exactly where I was going is, at the most fundamental level, being a Baha'i is just this inward, I guess an inward realization that you realize, yes, I do believe this, and then it's a matter between you and God. So there's no ritual component to declaring one's belief as a Baha'i. Interestingly, there is an administrative component. I think when people first hear about this, they sometimes think, well, that's kind of a dry way to proclaim your belief. Basically, what you can do is you can send in your name to the National Spiritual Assembly, which is the national governing body of the Baha'is in any country. You send in your name, and that can look like signing a piece of paper, and you know, seems a bit dry, because yeah, as you highlight, there are many faiths that have these beautiful moments that are really solemnized in a certain way of a declaration of belief. And maybe this is the political scientist in me talking. I think that this simple act of sending in your name to the National Assembly, for me, it's very cool, because we don't have a clergy, so we don't have a trained sort of class of believers who administer sacraments or have a sort of a particular role in mediating the religious life of the community in that way. So to govern our affairs, we have elected assemblies. So if your name is on the sort of on the rolls, as it were, then once you're an adult, you can vote and be voted for as a member of these local administrative bodies. There's no nominations, no campaigning. Anyone who is an adult in the community can potentially be voted for. And yeah, it takes on an entirely different character from any other kind of election I've ever been part of.
Interesting.
And through an indirect process, when you vote for your local assembly, through a series of stages, basically, you can contribute to the election of the Universal House of Justice, which is the governing body of the Baha'is worldwide, and is not only an administrative body, but also is designated by Baha'u'llah as having a particular, just it's a very sacred institution to Baha'is. So,
I mean, you are older than 15, so you have lived with this decision, you've progressed on through your life, and now you're working with the Journal of Baha'i Studies. So I think you view, I made a good choice, and you've continued to grow in this and continued to learn. I'm wondering, one of the things that impressed me the most was sort of a codification of goals, and you'll have to give me the correct wording, but there were certain things like establishing a universal language, things like equality of men and women, that there were a whole list of things. And I'm wondering, do some of those speak to you more than others? I mean, sometimes we each have a sense of mission within our larger faith. And I'm wondering if some of those have spoken to you or been important to you in your life.
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. That for me, some, like I believe in all of them, and then some of them feel like that's kind of that speaks to my heart. I'll say that the point that's reiterated in many, many places in the Baha'i Sacred Writings is that if you had to identify a fundamental principle in the Baha'i faith, sort of the seed, I think, from which everything else springs, it's the idea of the oneness of humankind. On one level, it's such a simple idea that it can sound almost trite, like everyone is one, we're all one. What does that mean? But in the way that Baha'u'llah uses that concept and then describes what its implications are for the nature of religion, of governance, of just humans, our collective life on this planet. The ramifications are both extremely broad and extremely deep when we look into it.
Yeah.
Now, I would say that that in a way connects to any other principle that you could name. For me, I would say the two things that really stand out for me. First, I've had a longstanding interest in Baha'u'llah's vision for the socio-political organization of the planet, where he essentially says, in one famous place, the earth is but one country and mankind its citizens. The Baha'i teachings go into some depth about the potential ways in which we could organize the planet in such a way that being born in a rich country or a poor country doesn't determine your destiny. So there's a vision for how we can generate real collective security together. And then beyond that, build a true, fundamentally collective identity on this planet that still preserves all the beauty of our cultural and historical differences. So that's one aspect of the teachings that I find very moving. And then the other, which I think is, it's a bit more niche, but this is the only article I've actually myself written in the journal, because as most of my other work is editorial. So it's about the treatment of animals, where I don't know why, but for whatever reason, from a very young age, I always had an intuitive love for animals. And I found that reflected in the Baha'i writings very early, where just as one example, so Abdu'l-Bahá, who's the son of Baha'u'lláh and an extraordinarily important figure for Baha'is, he says in one place that he's talking about the need to be kind to animals. And he says, the human being, when wronged, can speak out, can appeal to justice, can go to the courts, he specifically mentioned, which piqued my interest as a lawyer, but the animal can't. And it's interesting because in the history of Western thought, at least, this fact that the animal cannot speak, and therefore it was assumed cannot reason, has been used as an argument against us owing any duties to animals, that they can't really be moral agents. We don't owe them moral duties because they don't have the capacity of reason. But Abdu'l-Bahá says, it's absolutely true that the human capacity of reason is unique. And he says it's a spiritual capacity fundamentally, but the capacity to feel is shared between the animal and the human. And they can't articulate when they're harmed. And so that gives us a really profound duty of kindness to animals. I think that also speaks to me, not just because of that sort of personal feeling that I've always had of love for animals, but also I think because the treatment of animals is so tied up in general, the way that we interact with our environment, which is, of course, maybe the single most pressing issue confronting our species today. So,
as someone who has had pets probably since the age of 3 and still do today, 6 decades later, I resonate with the idea that you said that rather than, well, they can't reason, so they don't matter as much, instead saying they don't reason, but they feel, and thus we have an obligation to them as the reasoning ones. And that's very appealing to me, because that also applies to people. Whether it's we're talking about I have power and someone doesn't, or I have resources and someone doesn't, ties back into the oneness that you talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Michael, what brings you the most joy about your faith?
Oh, that's a great question.
And another question is, can you put your finger on why you believe in a higher power?
My answer to both questions has something in common about them, is that I live a lot in my head. Some people, I think, feel very deeply, and it's very at the surface for them, and they interact with the world in a feeling way. I tend to be closer to the other end of the spectrum, where I interact intellectually with the world and think about things. And so I could easily go on for hours about, this is what I find really interesting and cool about the Baha'i faith. And I could also then say, you know, a lot of the reason for belief in a higher power for me is intellectual, that I'm certainly interested in sort of the arguments on this debate, because it's a very old debate. It rises to the fore, and often, because our culture sort of chews everything up in a very conflictual way, the debate between religious people and people who are actively against the idea of religion can often be kind of ugly a little bit on both sides. But that's not to say that there aren't good arguments on both sides. So from an intellectual standpoint, having looked at probably not all, but quite a few of those arguments, I find the arguments for the existence of a higher power, and for that being the coordinating scheme of the universe, really, I just find them fundamentally more persuasive. But then it's interesting in terms of what gives me joy. For me, it's the history of the of the Baha'i faith. And religious history in general, I think I have an affinity for narrative. I mean, that's all humans have it. We have an inbuilt love of narrative and story. And sometimes, even if I'm the one telling the story, I teach a children's class in our neighborhood here, and it's open to people of all backgrounds, any faith and none, and the focus is really on building character virtues. But we recently had an event for a Baha'i Holy Day where I had the opportunity to just share a bit with the children in fairly simple terms, because some of them are as young as 4 or 5, just an episode from the history of the Baha'i faith. And reviewing that story and then telling it, I found profoundly moving. And it's a kind of joy, but it's the kind of joy where you start to sort of choke up and tear up. It's appreciating, I suppose, that you can understand history as a narrative of love, of God's expression of love to humanity, and then of humanity's response. And sometimes that response has been horrible, where the founders of all the religions have in their own way suffered horrible persecutions. Their followers have suffered horrible persecutions. But that darkness, in a way, casts the light in greater relief. And then when you see ordinary people, the humblest people, I mean, certainly in the history of Christianity, the early followers being the nobodies, the fishers who couldn't even read or write. That's reflected in the history of the Baha'i faith too, that utterly ordinary people doing extraordinary things out of this transformative love that they've experienced. I think, reflecting on that brings me this kind of teary-eyed joy.
Michael, that's a really beautiful way of putting that, with that image, if I can quote you, teary-eyed joy. And the fact that the history is so real to you as you're talking about the early adherence to the Baha'i faith, the early leaders, and the similarity of other faiths, including Christianity, where the earliest people were persecuted. There really is something moving in people's belief, motivating them enough and causing them to be dedicated enough to what they see as good and enlightening and improving the world, even if that causes difficulty for them when others don't see the world the same way. And I think at moments when we see people's heroism like that, something that's really important to each of us, there is that thing that kind of wells up inside of us, sometimes surprisingly.
Mm-hmm. I have long admired, since I first came across it, the Baha'i respect for the truth in the teachings of all of the preceding faith traditions and prophets and the holy writings, and just that there's a new iteration here. And also the desire for unity and the belief in the unity of all things and all people. Gosh, wouldn't that change the whole world if we could just be more effective at teaching that and believing it and acting upon it? I'm wondering what the Journal of Baha'i Studies is. Is this an academic journal? Is it people sharing specific thoughts about life experience and faith? Tell us more.
So the Journal of Baha'i Studies is an academic journal, so it's in some sense your standard peer-reviewed academic journal, and it's sort of under the umbrella of an organization called the Association for Baha'i Studies, which has been around since the late 70s, I believe, so it's quite a while now. And the way I would describe maybe the association as a whole is that if we accept this idea that all of us are here to contribute to the advancement of civilization, then a big part of what goes into any civilization, any stage, is knowledge. What do we know, and how effectively are we applying what we know and learning how it works and where maybe it doesn't work, and then refining our knowledge? So the Association of Baha'i Studies, broadly speaking, I think tries to advance knowledge about how, in, on the one sense, how the Baha'i revelation and the experience of the Baha'i community can speak to some of the issues, challenges, opportunities facing humanity, and simultaneously how the accumulating knowledge in the sciences and humanities can help us better understand the revelation itself. It's a principle in the Baha'i faith that science and religion are fundamentally in harmony. They're sort of like two wings of a bird that, when both are strong and working together, then the bird can fly.
One thing that I loved is that I was able to find this online. And if you were to give the website in case people want to just look this up while we talk about it.
Yeah, so the journal is entirely free to access. If you go to journal.bahaistudies.ca, then I believe. Yeah, and that can get you right to the front page of the journal. And yeah, all of our back issues are in there. And
what's the editorial mission behind the journal?
In a sense, the Journal of Baha'i Studies, even though everything in some way has to do with the Baha'i faith, it's very broad because you could have an article on economics in one issue. In the next issue, you have a highly metaphysical, theological article and kind of everything in between. I think some of the most interesting work that we've been doing recently is learning about collaborative scholarship. So the last two issues showcase articles by a group that is thinking precisely about this question of the harmony of science and religion. So I find that cool from an editorial perspective because it's a big area of learning for me. It raises a lot of challenges, but it's also very, I think, coherent with a Baha'i view of how knowledge should work, that we shouldn't be hoarding knowledge and using it as a weapon against each other. We should be learning how to generate it together, disseminate it widely. And I think these sort of collaborative projects are in keeping with that.
This episode was produced by James Sturdivant. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Ebert, Katarina Martinich, and Heather Bigley. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen, Ashton Parkinson, and Lauren Sandberg. Spread the word about In Good Faith by leaving a comment and subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. We think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. Find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. Our YouTube page is youtube.com/@in-good-faith. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join us again soon, right here in Good Faith. We speak every week with people of different religious traditions and faiths. They don't all agree, but we find the commonalities and we're inspired by their search and their journey. I want to recommend another BYU podcast I think you're going to like. It's Uncomfy, Sticking with Moments That Challenge Us. It's brand new. There's video as well as audio. And if you want to learn how to engage with others on important topics, but maybe you don't know how, or you've just had it with social media and people arguing and demonizing each other, check out Uncomfy, Sticking with Moments That Challenge Us. There's a new one every Wednesday. You can listen or watch on the BYU Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.